Okay, hello everybody, and welcome to another podcast with the Institute of Classical Osteopathy. And today we have Robert. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Diego.
Hello, and we have Alex again. Hello, Alex.
Hello. Hello, Diego. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again. Thank you for coming again and talking to all the followers that we have and talking about osteopathy. So today, Alex, you know Alex, but I was just looking to, you know, on Google, of course, but it's something that is, he's an osteopath, a naturopath, lifestyle consultant, but something that really is very nice. And he says, it's a nature cure is much more than a way of dealing with disease. It's essentially a way of looking at life. And I think when I talk to Alex, you get the feeling he lives the way he talks. Mm-hmm. So that's very nice. And we as osteopaths, I think we have to be kind of an example for patients as well, you know. Yeah. So, okay. Today, I wanted the last podcast, it was more about yourself and, you know, to know more, a bit more about you. But today, we would like to talk about, you know, different approaches to the patient's vitality, the inner force that the patient has. Of course, there are many definitions to health. You know, the more you hear, the more definitions that people get. But, you know, how would you look into the aspect of the patient's health when they come through the door?
Well, I suppose, how do I look at a patient's health? I mean, it's the overall question. So I suppose that those, as I said, maybe last time, I kind of like to just, first of all, get an appreciation of what the patient knows about me, because once I know really where they're coming from, what their understanding is of what I'm going to provide them, then I already have a better idea of what they're expecting. And then obviously I like to kind of say to them, look, if I was a genie and I had, I could give you as many wishes as you like, what would they be? And that would normally, I would say, you know, that would normally entail some form of musculoskeletal distress. They might be in some form of pain or ache or have some form of feeling in their body that they want to get rid of. But they might also have some other kind of ailments or some other issues that they might not necessarily associate with an osteopath. They might have period pain or migraines, or they might have some kind of bowel disturbance. So I'll say, you know, within this genie kind of thing, you can list as many musculoskeletal things as you like, but you can list some physiological things, you can list some mental or emotional or kind of lifestyle things that, you know, that it gives them the chance to say, yes, I've come in, you know, look, I've come in with my shoulder problem and I've got my back problem, but look, I mean, if you could help me with my eczema, that would be great. And, you know, I also have some IBS, but I'm also going through a divorce right now, you know, so I'm really stressed and, you know, or someone just died. And that already gives me a huge picture about them physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, what they're kind of going through. So I kind of have that already, that idea of where they're at. And then comes in sort of a little bit of me just explaining a little bit more about where I'm going to be directing them from. And then from there comes that sort of like that, just your gauge, you're picking up information about them all the time, aren't you? And so then it becomes a way of how to dress it. So I think that's what you were asking, like just in the sense of, you know, how do I pick up, I suppose, is that, you know, is that right?
Yes. That was what I was asking, because I suppose health is something very specific to every patient. It's not a definition that you can widespread to everybody the same sort of definition. So health, as you were saying, you know, someone going through a divorce might be different at that moment of life.
Yeah,
health for them.
Yeah, and you know, those kind of stresses already give me an idea as to how much adrenal overload they're in. You already get to pick up stuff about their emotions, their posture, what they want to talk about. I always remember people at university at the beginning sort of saying, you know, people might mention something quite important once or twice, and if you don't pick up on that in those early stages, that might be the little box, you know, they might really want to talk about those other issues. So those are kind of really important, I think, sometimes just to give them the awareness, first of all, that you might be able to offer them something much more than they feel you that they might have heard about. You know, and obviously my scope of what I believe is possible from an osteopathic alongside a nature cure lifestyle and those things, we have a way, as it's not an alternative to medicine, it's an alternative medicine. It is an alternative way of looking at the way that the body is. And so exactly as you said, you know, nature cure and all of these things have got a name for people who have normally gone through the medical profession and come out the other side, and they're a lost cause. And then exactly, they suddenly find these kind of crazy institutions, especially, you know, a couple of hundred years ago. But if we can try and my ideal is to offer people preventative medicine. It's healthcare, not disease care, you know. So I sort of very, very much the different to what the osteopathic college taught me at the beginning, not the ICO, but from the more mainstream osteopathic college of, find it, fix it, leave it alone. But they'd interpreted that as don't open Pandora's box. Mm. You know, don't try and get to the deeps the issues that the patient might be presenting with. Just try and superficially reduce their symptoms and kind of send them on their way. Mm. And of course, that classical approach is completely the opposite. You're looking to offer them the availability and the option of opening Pandora's box. Mm-hmm. And that within that, we have a philosophy that's able to tie together so many different avenues of their health that it's obviously not a surprise when they find that their hip is at the other end of the femur to their knee. And so mm-hmm. having a hip specialist and a knee specialist is kind of ridiculous if you've got the ends of the same bone. Well, that's kind of quite obvious to them. But sometimes if you're dealing with, let's say, their pelvis, for example, and they're thinking about their sacroiliac joint, that it doesn't immediately for them transfer into uterine fibroids or polyps in their digestive system or the ongoing inguinal or femoral hernia that they are about to be operated on. So I think that sometimes just giving them a chance to really open themselves up to say all of these different things, but also gives us the chance then to go back 5, 10, you know, sessions or years later and kind of see where they were at and then see that we can actually have a humongous effect on their entire life.
One of the things about osteopathy is that it's not disease centric, which is what you're talking about, Alex. It's health centric. Which is what, you know, Andrew Taylor Still first talked about. You know, it's easy to find disease, it's more difficult to find health. We engage with health, right? We don't ignore disease, but we engage with health and we consider disease as part of health, you know, which is what makes osteopathy a unique therapy or alternative treatment to mainstream medicine. And people don't understand that, and we have to try and get that over to them.
Treatment, we think of treatment as, you know, as you said, going to see someone when you're in a lot of pain. Mm. And you know, I'm happy to deal with people's pain, but it's much more pleasurable to treat people when they're out of pain. They have a lot more a scope in order to absorb the information that you're giving them. Mm. They have a lot more ability and energy and vitality and able to integrate the movements and the effect that you're giving to their body. Mm. It can be much more pleasurable. You can have longer treatments. Mm. your vitality is raised, your ability to go further is raised. And I always say to patients, you know, treatment really starts when you're out of pain. You know, treating someone in a lot of pain is a stressful thing. It's a stressful thing for us as osteopaths. Mm. You know, we don't like putting them through pain. We're trying to alleviate that, but there's only a certain amount you can do. Very often when they're in pain, they're very tired, they're in acute. So as we were talking about earlier, you know, that, you know, treatment has to be a lot shorter. So almost I say to them, like, you know, effective for your money or time for your money, you get more if you come in when you're not in pain. You get more, you get, and then you're coming in, maybe saying, yeah, I feel in a really great, great situation. And then you leave feeling even better. Then you're really into the, rather than trying to just hold up the wobbly house with scaffolding, you're really, really into regrouting and putting new floorboards in and deciding to sort of change the kitchen. And you're getting on top of that run-down house that we might have taken once upon a time when they're in acute or, you know, or they're in these chronic stages.
Underpinning really those foundations.
Yeah, you're laying those foundations. So I think you're absolutely right. Like treatment is a, can be really pleasant. And then, you know, it's an anathema to think, oh, I'll go for a nice massage when I feel good. But when I feel bad, I'll just go to the person that can make you feel pain. You know, you can still have a really enjoyable, you know, sleepy, dopey treatment that makes you feel much more energized and much looser and more connected to your body in many different ways. And, you know, that comes out, you know, when you're feeling better.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, the more we have on the one hand to teach patients to come to the osteopath when the body is asking. You know, I always say, you know, there are different times during the year that you might need to come more often, and you know, you just need to listen to your body. Your body is yours. You listen to it. And then obviously to teach them to look after themselves and come when they are not in acute pain. But going a bit, you know, on today's topic, I wanted to ask you, you know, about these patients that they come with an acute onset, or it can be, you know, sometimes you find on a musculoskeletal acute onset of tendinitis or throbbing headache, or they had a hernia, a sciatic pain. Obviously those patients they come, as you were saying, with a different vitality, pain, they are worried, moody. There are different aspects to those patients, and you know how difficult it is for the osteopath as well to deal with the patient on the table. You have to listen the tissues. How do you deal with these patients and make the best of those treatments, because they are difficult treatments?
Comfort number one, I reckon. I try and make the patient as comfortable as possible. It's warm. I don't like a cold treatment room. I liked having a nice oil heater nearby so that I can warm some towels. A lot of patients who will say, oh, I could just come for just for the towels. Nice kind of application. It already gives you the availability to use that heat or warmth as sort of gentle hydrotherapy, but trying to relax their adrenal tone, trying to calm them down. In calming them down, you start to alter their breath. Through their breath and through their heart rate and calming them down, you start to reduce that adrenal load. So first of all, if they're in a lot of physical pain, just physically making them as comfortable as possible. Holding them, supporting them with lots of pillows. So if they're on their back, maybe a pillow underneath their knees, maybe a nice warm towel that they might be able to lie on. Just first of all, trying to get them to that place. I would think that probably, you know, acute or not, I would probably have 60 or 70% of my patients fall asleep at some point during the treatment. So I want their body to almost physiologically disappear from their brain. They can't feel where it's at. So under the guise of, let's say, the, you know, the classical routine, for example, just using those different methods where their body is just put in so much position of ease or release that they're able to really drop. They're really able to drop and pass out. And there's a really wonderful fine line in palpation and holding them, which I'm sure you're aware of. Just when you might go from not stimulating treatment, but more musculoskeletal moving treatment, more through to what other people would consider to be maybe a functional cranial holding, fascially unwinding kind of position. But a lot of those patients will find that as you move around from limb to limb, from position, that those areas of their body almost disappear. That's what I like to imagine for the treatment. And that there are moments of, and, you know, I suppose this comes from my own hands, you know, this can't take it, but there's times where you feel that you need to rock or move or push or pull or sort of coax something out. And then there's other times where you need to really become part of that tissue tone with people within your hands. So you're really trying to pick up what that where the draw is, where the fascial pull is, what kind of words or emotions or textures or those things come to mind when you're palpating. I think really, like you said, just working out where the person is on their energy level, we mentioned vitality or breath of life or force, whatever that electricity is that departs when you pass away. And I don't know, but any listener who's been in the presence of a dead body. Okay, so what we're talking about is this presence of this level of vitality on this energy or breath of life, vital force, this electricity that departs when you're not there. Now, you know, especially in nature cure and all the way through, we talk about sort of we're given a battery, a certain type of battery life. It's the easiest analogy, isn't it, really? I mean, you know, it's not complicated, but it's just quite simple in the sense that the battery we're given when we're born is very specific to ourselves. You know, and so some people are born with great big double Duracell pack, double plus battery lives with a couple extra kind of strapped to them, and other people unfortunately are given some pretty dud batteries when they're first given, so they don't have a huge amount of scope. But that battery life goes up and down as well as progressively down through life. So obviously as we go, it's right running a battery, but I like to think that the body is a little bit like an electric car. When you're kind of running it and you take your foot off the gas, it uses the momentum to sort of partly charge the other electric battery. I'm not very good with electrics, but that's my understanding anyway. And so rest and sleep is incredibly important in the nature cure lifestyle, especially in both people who are in acute forms of distress or disease, and even more so in those people who are in a chronic state, because the energy of our the energy that we have in our body is needed for obviously repair and building, and it's needed for digestion, and the two of those factors, both digesting the food and repairing our body, will take up the majority of every day's daily activity. The rest of the pie chart of energy, for so to speak, we get to do what we want with it. But at the end of each day, if we don't sleep or we don't rest, you know, we've only got 2 or 3 days before we are malfunctioning on a serious physiological level. You know, it's not, you won't know many people that will just say, oh, I'm going to take a week where I don't sleep this week. I'm just going to do, you know, four days straight. It's not possible. Their body will start breaking down. And so physiologically, that battery starts to go right down into the red. But then when we do rest and we rest and sleep, we have times where our vital force will go back up again. But over a period of time, we're dropping that vital force, aren't we, as we go through life, which is why we have so much more vitality and vibrancy as a baby. And it's very often why we see so much of the body's innate healing mechanism wanting to express itself. And so we're kind of then back to maybe, I don't know, talking about maybe the energetics between somebody who's in an acute phase and somebody who's in a chronic phase. Well, I suppose what is an acute phase? An acute phase, the title itself suggests an increased inflammatory or eliminative effort by the body. Both of which, inflammation and irritation, are all parts of healing. You know, I remember, what are the signs of healing? Redness, swelling, pain, pressure. All of these things are where there's an increased blood supply carrying nutrient-rich blood to a tissue. And then there is some form of engorgement in the local tissue, which causes the venous and lymphatic kind of backup. But all of these things are showing an acute effort by the body to heal. And if it's a constitutional approach, as in if the body needs to do general cleaning within the body or general detoxifying, if it's not an acute, I've broken my leg or I've slipped over and sort of torn a muscle or those kind of things, if it's more of an acute illness, for example, we think of that again as a negative thing. But again, from the osteopathic and the nature cure world, we see an acute onset of an inflammatory or healing as being a process that the body has chosen to do.
Yeah, it's not the body going wrong, is it? You know, it's this cytokine release and this organization via the brainstem of sickness behavior, which is giving us instructions what we should be doing: sleeping, not eating, not having sex, and not running around and doing stuff. Which is why, you know, if you have a dog and it doesn't turn up for mealtime, you know, it's and it's upstairs asleep under your bed or something like that, you know, there's something wrong. It's in sickness behavior, which is your body's instructions telling you what you should be doing. But we're so good at ignoring that. I've got to go to work today. I'll take some tablets and that'll shut it all down, you know.
That's exactly the process. And so that's, you know, that's a really important point you're bringing up there, Robert, which is, you know, I guide patients right the way from day one about, you know, I might not talk about the acute crisis, but it's very, very early in their behavior and their knowledge and their understanding, especially if they're coming in with a chronic constitutional problem, that I'm going to be aiming to push them towards illness. You know, that it's through them being unwell that we will get the biggest jumps in their health.
Yeah.
Which at the beginning, to the layperson, they just think, well, what are you talking about? You know, illness is when I go to the doctor, I don't like it. But I would then turn it around and say, well, tell me one form of illness or one form of symptom that is a bad sign in your body. And actually, we find that, you know, those who are in a chronic state of disease, those people who are maybe stage four or later stages of cancer or lymphoma or really irritant inflammatory disorders, that they don't really ever have coughs and colds. Their acute phases have kind of gone. they will very often in their case history talk about maybe their early onset eczema, and then that developed into their asthma, and then the asthma went away in their teenage years, and then they got colitis, and oh, but then they went to university, and then they got ME or chronic fatigue syndrome or some kind of long misunderstood condition when they were already hugely toxic, hugely tired, going off to university and like not sleeping and drinking and eating all the wrong things. And then subsequently later to that, after the ME stages, then in their early 20s, they might start showing up with some kind of autoimmune condition or some form of more chronic situation. And maybe at that point, they might also say, well, you know, I don't really get much colds, or I haven't got a fever anymore. And I don't really sweat. You know, you talk about them kind of going to the gym or whether they exercise and whether they can get a sweat going. Well, they say, well, you know, I do actually try and do some exercise, but I very rarely sweat. You know, and so you realize that there are all these areas of their body that are physically and physiologically closing down. They just have windows that are sort of rusted shut in their house, and they're not even aware of some of these portals. So I don't know, like, how you gauge that. I mean, everything from their look in their eyes, their temperature, the way that, you know, how much they want to, I would say how much they want to talk, but I talk a lot, don't I?
Yeah, some people talk more than others, don't they?
You know? But, yeah, but, you know, I often like seeing patients, or sometimes patients, where they seem really, really quite wired. And they're talking a lot, and then you lie them down, and I have a pretty much a rule. I don't talk in treatment, or I do if I'm just directing them to just really feeling what I'm trying to do for them, or I'm constantly saying, you know, you don't need to respond, but just pick up this what I'm about to tell you about your body. But I don't need them kind of talking to me, and I don't want any hairdressing osteopathy or what you're doing this weekend or how are you doing this. I really want them to just fall into their body, not talk, to relax their tongue, relax their jaw, to relax their eyes, to look completely comatosed on the plinth, and for them to know that I won't jump on them, and I won't do something sudden, and there won't be any sudden clicks, or there won't be anything painful. This is going to be the most luxurious, nice, pleasant treatment that they can do, and their only role is to try and play dead, to give me their body. And when I say to them, oh, relax or let this go, for them not to worry, but then for just to understand that that's their nervous brain holding onto an area of their lip, that their body that I just want to let go. But I find it very interesting as to sometimes very often it's the people who are really overstimulated, quite adrenal, maybe have a thyroid issue, maybe kind of have got a bit of redistribution of body fat on their face and their back. And you're thinking what's going on with their adrenal glands and what's happening with their body. And they lie themselves down and maybe within a couple of minutes of treatment, they're asleep, like really fast, deep asleep. I've seen it a lot in my parents' world, because obviously my parents were really famous ballet dancers. So I've seen a lot of actors and a lot of on stage people who are very good at putting on a face that everything's fine. Showtime. My mom used to call it something in teeth, but it was very much like
a woman's part and teeth.
Just over the top, like I'm fine and this and that, and then maybe you just give a little bit of support and relaxation and the tears start flowing, or the emotion starts coming out, or they say, you know, when they do start coming down and all these, you know, negative thoughts or negative things start happening in their body, or you start to relax them and boom, they're out cold, like so deep asleep. And that very often comes from that physiological changes, I find, especially through the sort of somatovisceral reflexes, as you're kind of holding areas of their body. Sometimes you're finding that when you're moving them around, musculoskeletally, as in mechanically moving them, something might be held or quite tight, but it's not a mechanical restriction. Then maybe you hold onto that limb and you just feel it and let it relax and ease, as we said, fascially, or sort of that, these terms of just trying to make it a little bit more comfortable, make it disappear. And you feel these little tissue releases. And at the same time, you feel these gurgles, grumbles. You know, if you're holding the right arm, you might feel that release coming through the right side of the diaphragm or within the liver as the phrenic nerve maybe affects itself. And there's these drops. And then through these, you know, how often will the patient, oh, sorry, I think I'm hungry, or I've eaten something, or I've done another. You know, they only say that on the first or the second treatment. And then they're just aware of how much, when you pick up certain areas of the body, you can almost direct them to where that gurgling is going to happen. And they really understand that presence. And then I really like that feeling that comes with whether it's more reducing the sympathetic tone or allowing the expression of the parasympathetic, allowing safety and allowing the digestion to kick off and allowing that energy flow, that blood flow to enter into the splanchnics and enter into the visceral system, the visceral organs let go. Very often that gives them that dopey, sleepy, but they're already laid down, and that calmness and that lets them really go. And then you're able to play, aren't you? Play in between conscious and unconscious. You really get the feeling of, oh, really how the tissues are, without any of this sort of social and environmental construct that we put on us, what people are thinking. In fact, I had a therapist locally recently, or a patient, someone I'm doing swaps with in Stroud, and he's been bringing his daughter to see me. And she only came for the second treatment, and he dropped her off. She's 16. And I said, he came to pick her up, he said, how did it go? And I said, well, I always feel that if you can get a 16-year-old girl to fall asleep at about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when they're not tired, in the presence of another guy in a room, it just really shows safety. It really shows just relaxing on their body on a deep level. You know, it's just that I love it when kids come in after school and they're all like really jumped up and a little bit of treatment, and these, you know, 7 to 12-year-old kids will just pass out like so deep that their parents can hardly wake them up or get them off the plinth. I mean, it's the middle of the day, you know, and sometimes they've even had sugar just before they came in. And I think that is really, and then that to me is a sign of how, you know, A, how connected they are to their body, how responsive they are, but it also gives me this gauge of how tired they are. You know, how much are they stimulated in their outside world? How many people will sit down and they never watch a film because they turn the TV on and they fall asleep straight away? Like, just so underneath that superficial, I've just woken up and my vital force has raised ever so slightly and I'm ready to go again. How long can that carry on? So I think that's an interesting sort of marker, at least, for seeing where the people are at. And then it sort of transfers, doesn't it, into, like, as we said, how to take somebody from a chronic situation more towards an acute situation.
I was just before we carry on, I want to highlight to the audience that, I mean, everything you have said has got such a deep understanding of the body and the experience of an osteopath. An osteopath is someone who has been in contact with the skin of a patient for, I don't know, 20 years.
Yeah.
Seeing patients, 10 patients, 10 people every day, palpating the skin, the reaction, looking into those changes in the person. I mean, it's amazing the amount of information that you just gave like that. Mm-hmm. And I would like people to understand, you know, since you were talking about this acute patient that comes to the clinic and you make them comfortable, or these patients that you say the gut start to, you know, to move around. You're talking about not techniques. We haven't mentioned no one technique. We are talking about sympathetics, parasympathetics, reaction of the patient, make them comfortable, which is osteopathy. Is simple, but at the same time, it's complicated how you manage those patients. What technique are you going to do? What, a functional technique, a spiritualism? Yeah. I don't know. It's just, in my opinion, you mentioned something really important, which is rocking, which is oscillation, which is that inner movement that we all have in our body. As you were saying, the life force, when someone is dead, is dead. There is no oscillation in that body.
Yes.
So that's the main technique, I would say. And then working with the nervous system. I mean, sorry, Alex, it's just I wanted to emphasize that because I think it's so important.
Because the thing is, I mean, I'm constantly trying to find ways of describing to people what I feel. And you know, and this is, look, it's not to try, I don't want to try and put myself on a pedestal. I can only say what I say, but, like, you know, there's the intellectualization of reductionist mechanical movement. You can teach that to anybody, but it doesn't mean that their hands feel right. you can teach someone the art of, or maybe throwing clay on a pot on a wheel and trying to create a vase. But some people will just have a way of molding and blending and it's just easy.
Well, that's the art in the science, isn't it?
The art in the science, yeah. Mm. So all of these nuances where we're trying to, I try and push towards a practitioners or students to kind of think, you know, what is this texture? What does it feel underneath you? Mm. Is this hard, cold, frozen butter, or is it margarine in a pot? Is it hard in the middle, defrosted, but it's soft on the outside? Could you hold something that's hot on the cold on the outside, and can you try and imagine heating the inside, transmitting vibratory force without kind of actually doing anything to it? It's all quite interesting. And so I think you saying about the vibration or oscillation. I mean, I remember it was like, you know, Arild Lademann and harmonic technique back in the sort of 90s or 2000 or whatever, of pushing something and rhythmically feeling how it comes back. And within that, you're already on a frequency, aren't you? You're playing like a guitar. You're playing a dong. You're pushing something and you're feeling the rebound. Within that rebound, because underneath our hands, we can flay skin off. You can go skin, superficial fat, you know, outside of a muscle sheath, inside of a muscle sheath, underneath, in through the ligament, in through the capsule, into the bone. In the bone itself, you can hold the limb and push through the limb and bend the bone itself. So you have this depth of layers all the way through. So, you know, I like to say to patients, it's like if I put my hand on the top and the bottom of a patient's body, it's as if I'm trying to imagine in my hand, as if I held a football, have I got a, if there are elastic bands from every different angle of the football to the other side?
That's quite wonderful, Alex. And you know, one of the things that is really wonderful about that is learning to trust what we feel. It's understanding the layers of what we feel and trusting that, rather than someone saying, oh, but in research it says you shouldn't trust what you're feeling. We have to trust what we feel.
You've got no other choice. The thing is, you just do it in every other element of life anyway.
Yeah.
You've got to trust yourself all the time. Sometimes there are rules, and then you say, I've got to trust what I'm feeling. Yeah. It feels like it's going to rain. It feels like my kids are going to be ill. It feels something's going to happen. You have to trust in that.
Yeah.
And so within this, I kind of imagine like having a bunch of students and 10 students holding like an Egyptian cotton sheet, and you've all got them all blindfolded, and you're going to make a hole at some point in the middle of the sheet somewhere, and everyone's got to work together to try and work out where the rip is in the sheet, you know, who pulls at what angles that could create a pulling and so you start to create a three-dimensional helical shape in the body of what you imagine is going to be there. And when you put your hands on, you start to have these sensations of pulling in, and puckeredness and tissues that are harder and they have less vibrancy and less give and less pull, and you're tractioning it, but you can feel that it's not a fresh, bouncy elastic band. You know, how many Christmas games you could blindfold people, games that you put your hands into and you hold on to things, and they're just thinking, what is this thing in the game at Christmas? Everyone's going to be putting it up. But you could do it with elastic bands. You could do like, what's the quality? Let's have 100 grades of elastic band. You know, bouncy, small, thin, thick, brittle, some that are about to crack. You know, and some people, they'll pick it up and they'll already know, this is a bit frayed and a bit plasticky and it's dry, and I can feel that it's gonna ping. Oh yeah, that's exactly where it was gonna be. You can feel these moments in the same way I say to a patient, you know, if you imagine a green stick, a bendy stick that you pick up in the park, and you can think, I can bend this whole thing around, and it's going. But another one, you pick it up and you know that I'm gonna break it. It's just there, and you can feel that moment before.
And that is part of detecting health, isn't it? Detecting the health in the tissues.
Yes. And so sometimes that vibrancy is too low. And so sometimes you need to listen to Diego, like that oscillation you were saying. Sometimes you need to kind of shake the limb up a little bit. And sometimes you need to slow it back down.
Exactly.
Sometimes you need to hold on to it, to give it safety, to subdue it with tactileness that is giving comfort and confidence. It's like holding a baby, you know, holding a baby. You can hold them lightly in one hand, holding them, and they can feel completely secure. Or you can hold them really erratically with a load of fear, and they can be really scared about the way that you feel holding them. You know, that's why I've got all these videos, haven't we? I've got my, you know, my girls like balancing on my hand at 11 weeks old, because we're very good at feeling the structure and feeling the balance and feeling these tissues, but then they can also feel that within us. And so it's a bit of a play within the tissues.
Also the temperature, you know, when you realize that something is really cold, an area of the body or very hot, you know,
sweaty.
So that's another element you put into those tissues.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that temperature is one of the best ones, because the most important part of any healing anywhere is heat, isn't it? Really,
exactly,
you know, heat melts viscosity. It ups the metabolic rate. So on a constitutional problem, you can't have an acute eliminative effort without a fever. It's not possible. And that's why, you know, we're looking to support that fever in a patient. We're not looking to suppress it. So the number is irrelevant to me. What the number is on the thermometer is completely irrelevant to the behavior of the person in front of them. And in fact, actually, making parents put thermometers away is something very important, especially when the kid is, you know, when Joey's running around or with his top off and they want to try and pull him in from the garden, you know, the fact that he has a fever is irrelevant, you know.
Yeah, or the child with that huge stream of green snot out of both nostrils, but happy running around doing stuff, and they're terribly Absolutely. Concerned about this snot coming out of his nose, but the child doesn't care, he's having a great time.
And quite often by the time that the snot has come out, it's already gone through that acute phase where you in the production of the snot, in the liberation of the snot deep within the cellular membranes and the mucous membranes beforehand, the fever is preceding it. Hence the whole, you know, germs and bacteria. There's a lot of time in those early acute phases that you swab the tissues, whatever tissues you're dealing with, and there's very nondescript forms of bacterium or pathogens that are around. Later on, per se, especially when the fever's dropped, that's when the elimination comes. You know, first comes the fever, the shivering, the achiness, the complete lethargy in bed. It's 2 or 3 days later when you're walking around and find that you're bringing up all of your snot or the sputum, and the actual eliminating the gunk has been produced by the body, and then it starts to come out of one of those organs of elimination.
Yeah.
I just wanted to go back. I interrupted you when you were going to talk about, you know, you said those patients that they eliminated, they cut those acute onsets that they get, spots, diarrhea, vomiting. You know, we know, you know, through the childhood towards the adulthood, people just ignore those signs, and then they become chronic. How different is an acute to this chronic, and they haven't developed any fever or any diarrhea or any elimination process or sweating that you mentioned? Yes. Very important as well.
Very important. So they're all like new apps we need to upload on their body, and we need to give them the opportunity to relearn again. In order to do that, we kind of go back to the vital force, which is they need to alkalinize their system in order to allow their body to start to liberate the acid toxic load that's inside of them. And at the same time as generally overhauling their life with an alkaline view, it is to go through a form of conservation of energy. I explain to patients the term sort of stimulation and enervation. And so enervation is the use of nerve power in order to eliminate toxins from the body. And when they get enervated, they start to lose out their body power, the wattage in the electrics running through their walls starts to drop. And so when their energy is lowered in the day, it reaches a point where their body just doesn't have enough to start elimination. So elimination is checked. So that's why when one of those fundamental three things, when we go into an acute condition, we go through total conservation of energy. So that is the lethargy that the body has, which is just saying, I want to crawl into bed and I don't want to move. My body is aching and I do not want to move. But it also conserves not through just through movement, but from physiological activity. So that's when the fast kicks in. And so the fast thing is then the body saying, I don't want to spend 50% of that daily energy that I've got on digesting the food. And I don't want to spend another 30% of it running around doing useless things. So we have lethargy and we have a loss of appetite. And then the third thing is all you need, which is a fever. The fever then ups the metabolic rate, which causes the body to start to break down the local pathogens. And then the increase in heat allows the breaking up of solid material into liquid material. And it allows our body to start going through that acute eliminative effort. So then we use our skin, our lungs, our kidneys, our liver, or our uterus for the elimination. But in those later stages, as you said, Diego, we've got people who are in a chronic state, and they don't have the availability. They don't normally have that. So then what we're trying to do, as we said, is conserve the energy that they've got and be wary of the fact that, especially through the classical osteopathic approach, I feel that we have to be very, 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 very careful, especially as to the amount of power we each wield within the ability to do things to the body that the body might not be ready for.
Yeah.
So the ego really has to step out the way and to start to take in the effect of how big, how small, how tired, how exhausted, how toxic, how is this patient looking in front of me? Because I can go in there with a wrecking ball and I can start knocking down walls and I can start ripping up floorboards. But if this house is unstruck and is unsafe, then it's very, very easy to send them into a treatment crisis rather than a healing crisis. And that is what I find, I think, is very, very important.
That's key, yeah. That's
important. Because the difference between these three is, as I try to label them over a long period of time, but that first one, I don't know whether we spoke about this last time, but what I call a toxic crisis is somebody who's woken up after, you know, the night before, when they think, oh, if I go out tonight and I go drinking, or I go and have a curry, or I go to the works party, I really don't want to do it. I don't feel very well tomorrow. I think I'm going to be ill. But they do it anyway, and they go to the party and they drink the drinks and they eat the wrong foods and all that kind of stuff. And yes, per se, they wake up the following morning with a streaming nose or a hangover, but they also feel really achy. And now they're definitely starting to feel a bit acute. Well, that's what I would consider to be a toxic crisis. The body is using the organs of elimination and using the fever that you're presenting with to try and survive. It's just trying to get rid of the surplus overload of toxicity within the system.
This is like the superficial level, isn't it? It's just the
tired, I'm stressed, I've been eating the wrong things, my body is toxic, and I know that I need to take care of myself better, but I'm about to feel ill. And the body says, well, look, if I hold on to this stuff even longer, then I'm going to go into a chronic state of illness. I'm going to be chronically storing all this rubbish. So if I acutely get rid of this, I'll be in a much better state. So a hangover, for example, is not a healing crisis. It's not a healing crisis, as I would like to put it. It's not jumping you to a whole new level of health. It's just repairing you from the overindulgence the night before. So that's a toxic crisis. And then there's a treatment crisis, like that same person, for example, that I've just mentioned, just before they're being ill, they might say, oh, I'm going to go and see Diego. I'm going to go and have some nice treatment. He said to come in when I'm not in pain. Well, I'm definitely run down and I definitely don't feel very good at the moment, but I'll go along. And then we get really over the top involved where we like, oh, we want this patient to feel better and we want them to sleep better. And oh, this treatment is going really well. And their body's responding. In fact, they're physiologically just begging, the body's begging for some treatment, but we give too much. Or we treat their body and we open all of these vessels up and we provide nutrient rich blood and we open up all of this venous and lymphatic flow. And we open up all of these energetic expressions of nerve energy. But of course, what we've effectively done is maybe gone and rod the sewer and let this huge avalanche of water come in, but none of the rice fields are ready for it. And so it just destroys the rice fields rather than having some form of irrigation. We haven't prepared the body. We haven't reduce the toxic load. We haven't told them to eat healthier. We haven't taken this. We've just said, oh, you know, the rule of the artery is supreme. Well, that's what Andrew Taylor still said. So I'm just going to make sure there's a fresh blood supply. But I'm like, well, what if the blood supply is just filled with horrible, poisonous, toxic matter? I mean, you're just pumping all of this stuff around the body. And that's exactly what can happen. So we lower the adrenal tone, we improve all of the plumbing, but the patient is in a chronic state, is an awful state anyway. And so we, through reducing the adrenal load, allow the tissues to dump a whole load of extra toxins into the bloodstream. But of course, it can't cope, and the skin hasn't been opened up, and the body hasn't prepared itself in any way. And so the patient has a really lovely reaction, but they phone you up the following day and they say, I don't know what happened. I've got a very bad cold today, or I'm stuck on the loo, or I'm, you know, I've got a really bad headache. In fact, my migraine's kicked off. And very often we have to realize that that is a treatment crisis. We have triggered a crisis in a patient through our own powerful mechanical influence on that person's body. But it is not a healing crisis come from within the person's body, because otherwise they would be phoning us up. And then that is the route to number door number three, acute crisis number three. Well, acute crisis number three is a really true healing crisis. And that is where somebody has made changes in improving their environment on the external, the exogenous and the endogenous toxins that the body is producing from outside and from within. And they're reducing that toxic load by breathing fresher air, by taking some sunlight in, by having more rest and sleep to up their vital force, by reducing the load of, you know, alcohol and refined foods and sugars and processed foods and candies and chocolates and alcohol and coffee and all these kind of other things. And they've upped their alkaline intent, and they've started walking and moving, swimming lightly rather than overpowering themselves with lactic acid anaerobic respiration. And they've made all these things so that they're having more alkalinity in their body, and they're reducing the acid load, and they're also conserving their own energy whilst dealing with maybe their alcoholism or their, you know, relationship issue or their financial difficulties. You know, they might be seeking something else on a mental and emotional or environmental or a community level that they require also. And then they start to increase in their vitality, and they lose a little bit of weight, and they feel a little bit stronger, and maybe they're sleeping a little bit erratically, but they're sweating in the nighttime, but then they're getting some occasional good night sleeps, and you see them, and this tissue quality is changing whilst you're treating them, and it's improving. And then, just like Mr. Wernham used to describe about the crashes, then comes the time when one day they just say, you know, I don't feel so good tonight. I want to fall into bed. I feel a bit feverish. I don't really feel like I feel off. Like, water tastes funny to me, you know, and there's a little bit of swelling in my knee, and my gouty toe feels a bit weird. But I just feel like I don't feel very well. And they crawl into bed, and but that is a healing crisis that's come with inside of their body. Their body's been cleaning, their body's been organizing their house, their body's been creating space and taking things to the dump and taking things to the charity shop, and they're getting everything ready and they're priming the walls. And then one day they're ready, and the kids have gone to school for a couple of days, and they've got a day, and they decide, I'm going to just open that cupboard and I'm going to paint this wall. I'm going to make some house improvements I've really been wanting to do for a while. And because they've made those changes, the instigation of that acute crisis, that sore throat, those things, comes from within the patient. It's very different. And when that happens, it's so much easier to manage. It's so much easier to support them. There's far less chance of there being a secondary, you know, superimposed reaction that we didn't see. And very often you'll be able to speak to them. And what does it feel that you want to do? I feel tired. I want to crawl into bed. Okay. And what else do you want to do? I don't want to eat anything. I feel horrible. Okay. What else do you want to do? Well, I'm really dehydrated at the moment. I'm drinking and I'm really thirsty all the time. Okay. And is there anything else you want to do? Oh, I'm just so tired. I don't want to talk to anybody. Well, then turn off the phone and go back to bed and take a glass of water, and don't worry about not doing anything, and allow your fever to run and call me when you wake up, for example. Those acute episodes are much shorter. They're much more manageable. And it took me many, many, many years of looking at the intricate differences between natural hygiene, nature cure, classical osteopathy, and what we are trying to do with our patient, and when the patient has the reaction from inside of them. And it's a very interesting concept, because we can see that 200 years ago, in Europe, where there were all these nature cure institutions, they used lots of ways of pushing the patient towards an acute crisis. Mm. They wanted the patient to get an acute crisis. So they dunked them in the cold water. They put them in the sunlight. They gave them massages. They gave them mechanical treatment. They gave them osteopathic treatment. They dumped them back in the cold water again. They flooded them with alkaline foods and they dumped them back in the water again. And then they took them for another massage and then they gave them the exercises outside. And they physically pushed them really fast into these acute crises. Mm. But then they took these
and some enemas.
Yeah, and some enemas. And they pushed the patient into they wrung them out. They got a sponge and they got the patient a sponge and they wrung them like that. Mm. And, you know, and you have all these priestess books where they talk about, you know, the patient's ears are bursting and there's, you know, there's snot coming out of their eyes and they're developing cholera. And the whole kind of shebang is up in the air. But they manage it because they could do, because legally wise, a lot of these people had just submitted themselves to this treatment and they'd gone to these health sanatoriums and they were probably rabid and they're full of diabetes and cardiovascular diseases, 1800s, and they either had that or bloodletting. And so they let them do that. Mm. Of course, we can't do that now. We'd be sued through our eyeballs. So the only way you can really do it nature is not to really do the nature cure version, but more of the natural hygiene version. And the natural hygiene version with Herbert Shelton and everybody else who came from that were very much more of a let alone therapies. They were much more about lifestylists, about saying to the patient, that everything resolves around you. You have the power to do everything, but you have to do it because any external influence is messing with the internal healing mechanism and starting cogs turning and momentum starting where we're talking about this as if we know it, but there's so much that we don't know in the patients. We have to alleviate that because there are so many interconnecting variable factors.
But we have to rely on nature for that and our understanding and our trust in nature.
Bingo. That, don't we? Bingo.
And just going back to the nature cure thing, you know, the forcing the crisis, that's not going to be a great way of getting cleaning the cellular space, is it?
No, it's not. And so that's why there is really interesting topics in the natural hygiene world, because they are very much against osteopaths and very much against hydrotherapists and very much against chiropractors because of this egotistical, I'm going to walk in, I'm going to wade in, and I'm just going to just change this from good tissue to bad tissue. And they know that you can't do that.
Yeah.
And Mr. Wernham was very, very strong about that. You can't turn the toxic to the untoxic. That is the patient. And you can't change those things, but you can alleviate blockages. You can improve blood flows and you can improve drainages, but we have to see that in the context of the bigger picture. Because if you don't do that, and everybody has them. I've had them. We've all had them where you treat someone, you treat them too much. There's been an acute crisis the following day. But then it's really important that you don't panic. You don't leave the person stranded. Oh, I don't know what's going on. I'm really sorry. You probably better phone your doctor. Because you have opened Pandora's box. And so then we sometimes have to let them know that it's okay if they have to shut the box, but it's okay. We might have opened it up a little bit too far that time. And that's that judgment call that we have to do. But it does mean that you can give a lot of people great lifestyle advice and you can start the treatment way beyond they even come to see you. And a lot of these techniques and these ideas are enough that the person can call you at the top of a mountain with no access to anything other than their own body. And you can teach them how, you can tell them how to fast, you can tell them how to sleep, you can tell them how to do some basic forms of hydrotherapeutic, measures to reduce or improve the circulation or increase the temperature or lower the temperature ever so slightly, just to produce some form of comfort if it's required. But that is also gauged on the person's understanding. So for example, myself and Jasmine, my wife, we were at university together 23 years ago. We haven't used any form of medical intervention over that entire time, or at least since 1 year after leaving university. So that's no painkillers, no intervention, no medicines of any version. That's Jasmine having two children at home. That's both of our children never seeing the inside of it. And that's me managing, you know, crazy stuff like knocking myself unconscious at a skate park and like trying to get myself out of Gloucester Hospital before they admit me, you know, because you have ways of through drainage or movement or circulation or hydrotherapy or meditation or breath work or anything to control what you're feeling. But these are all feelings. So once we understand the symptoms, we can manage it. If you understand the feelings that might come from, I'm not a female and I haven't given birth to a baby. I've witnessed two births and I've witnessed a lot of people who have free birthed their baby or birthed them without medication. Well, you know, from the external, you could go into that room just before the baby was about to being born. And if you'd never seen anything before, you'd think that there was something horrendously, terribly wrong going on with the female. And if you had a big needle in your hand that said you could just take all of that pain away, well, with the amount of screaming or noise or movement or energy or emotion that was being shown, you might think, well, why would I not offer this to the person? But of course, you offer that to a, you know, free birthing natural mum, they might, you know, they might throw it straight back in your face and tell you where to go, because you might be saying, well, you're making a lot of noise. It sounds like you're distressed. And they'll say, well, have you tried pushing a baby out of your, you know, and see whether you're going to make any noise? And then, of course, we realize that the only person who can understand what the person's feeling in the symptomatology is themselves, is the patient. Anything external of that, we're already layering our own judgment, you know. And if you have 10 osteopaths, all of our understanding as to our past, our experiences, what we felt ourselves, what our partners, our children have felt, what we've done for our children, what we feel guilty about, you know, that all comes into conference. So some people will say it's totally fine to medicate your children. Well, why not just give them Calpol and antihistamines and Puritans? Why not do it? It just makes your life easier. It makes them sleep better. It makes the kids like not moan. It makes them be quiet. Well, yeah, that's the case. But, you know, we also understand that their bodies understanding how to build an immune system will do them all the good later on and stop the 20 years worth of us trying to unwind them from a chronic state of disease to a state of acute stage that we've got to teach them in their 50s that having a fever is going to be okay this time round. And of course, we're 3 years down from the COVID pandemic and everybody's only just about able to have a cold nowadays because they realize it's not going to cost them two weeks worth of self-isolation and a lot of judgment from their friends. And so actually, whether you've been vaccinated or unvaccinated or COVID or not COVID, it doesn't matter anymore because everybody realizes that everybody can get it and everybody can hold it and everybody can pass it on. But we're back to the stage one, which is still nobody really understands or is told via the mainstream as to how to manage an acute crisis. And it's the most fundamentally important thing that you can possibly do. And if you're going to, so I'm getting excited, but if you're going to unwind a patient from a chronic state of disease to a state of what you might consider to be much more healthy practice, it would be crazy. In fact, it would be stupid to think that you could do that without there being some form of acute eliminative or inflammatory effort by the body. It would be great if it could, but it's just not the physiological rule and it's not what happens in the body. And so therefore we have to be prepared that that's exactly what our body's going to do. And so if we teach them that, that's much, much easier. And I've find it extremely exciting, especially when people are like, you know, first, second, third stage cancer, they've gone through some form of alternative, or they've gone through some medical treatment, or maybe they've gone through some non-medical treatment, and you get them to their first kind of crisis that might take them 2 or 3 years. But like to see somebody phone you up and be really excited that they've got a cold, really excited. Yeah. And that is just that is a whole thing, you know, and the same thing with children. What happens after an acute crisis with kids is that the parents feel ruined and the child feels wonderful. If you manage it right, then the child doesn't sleep very well. They burn a fever for maybe 2 days and they're coughing and they're spluttering and they're coming into the bed and they're waking you up and they're all like, and they're grouchy and their tummy hurts. And then they're not hungry, but they ate something before and it's still sitting in their system. And you just have 2 or 3 days worth of all of this acute fever buzzing of energy with inside of them. But of course, you're exhausted because you're trying to hold together your job and you're not sleeping at night time. And you've got the two kids sleeping in between you and your partner, or on your own if you're unlucky, and you're managing single parenting. Mm. And of course, then after 2 days of running a fever, the child goes like, "Woo, I feel brilliant. I'm really hungry now, mummy. I'm hungry." And they become a gannet, but they've also upgraded their system. They've like learned a lot. They physiologically start walking or talking. Mm. They start riding a bike, or they their tooth comes through, or their skin starts eliminating, or their new hair starts growing, or their nails start, or all these kind of things start happening. The child feels amazing. The parent feels horrific because they're exhausted.
Yeah.
But swap that around the other way, and normally we're just used to medicating the children with Calpol and everything just to make them sleep, because I've got to go to work the following day. And, you know, I don't want the kids being awake because I'll just be tired all the time. Mm. And then quite often the kids just never really get that, you know, they don't get a proper acute crisis. So then it comes back 2 weeks later, or a month or 2 months later, and then it goes in this cycle, or they get that cold, but they never really get much better. And then rather than that, their guts start playing up. And we started the cycle of never having a good, fast, proper, well-managed acute crisis. Mm. Which, as I said in those analogies before, is like taking all of that rubbish out in your garden. Mm. And one day when there's no wind and it's a nice sunny day and none of your neighbors are around, you decide to burn that bonfire.
Mm.
And you set light to it. And what do you want with a bonfire? You want it to be well controlled, but you want it to burn fast, because if it burns fast, you get less smoke. Mm. So what you don't want to do right when your bonfire is burning is for your neighbor to come over and chuck two buckets of water over it and a sort of like, you know, wet rag, because then it's just smoldering and it's smoky, and then the smoke's going everywhere, and then you're coughing and you can't see what's happening, and you're not sure whether you should pour some petrol back on the bonfire because then it might blow up the petrol, and you you just got to wait till it all starts again. It's very unsatisfying.
Yeah.
Whereas you want that thing to burn fast, and then you, as an osteopath, if you've done the lifestyle things and if the patient has taken on those, then the acute crisis is so much easier to manage. You're just there to just monitor it. You don't need to do anything gung-ho.
Mm. I would say, Alex, sorry, it was coming to my head that we're talking about kids, but also when you have adults that they come with, normally they have more acute musculoskeletal pains because they have been, you know, neglecting all the other symptoms. When and you know, we have doctors that they recommend not to take any painkillers or anti-inflammatories, and if you see those patients that they have this acute onset and they go to hospital and they put injections, cortisone, anti-inflammatories, they come out of that acute episode much worse than someone who just took rest, relaxed, inhibiting those adrenals, had some treatment, and they come out much stronger. You can see that or feel that in the tissues as well. I mean, it's also, you know, within that musculoskeletal aspect. Yeah, as well.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah, I 100% agree. But then it's back to the whole thing of suffering. You know, most of medical intervention, at least on the acute, not on the acute like trauma side, but the management of the chronic or the acute constitutional, is the suppression of the inflammatory organs that are eliminating.
Mm.
So your skin and your lungs and then your kidneys, all of these areas inside of your body that are eliminating waste. Then they get itis stuck on the end of it, or the, you know, asthma and eczema and bronchitis and laryngitis and asthma, all of these kind of external factors that are simply signs, aren't they, that the body is tiring, and the patient's feeling tired, the patient's feeling run down, they're just at their wits' end on so many fronts. And what is very difficult for people to understand is that it is more pleasurable to take 2 or 3 days off work guilt-free, try and spar yourself into a better state of health when you're not in pain, or you wait until your body just prostrates you and sticks you in bed for 3 days feeling absolutely raging in pain, because you are not listening to any of the signs. And I find it amazing how, like, in our 30s or 40s, I think we're stuck at desks. the majority of professions. And we become ninjas of sitting. We're so strong at sitting, but we can't do anything else. We can't stand up any longer. We've lost the flexibility to stand up in a straight mechanical line. We're sort of slightly chair-shaped. You know, our knees are forward, our glutes are backwards, our chin is forwards, our diaphragm's tight, our chest is collapsed, our guts are falling out, the inguinal link, everything's just chair-shaped. And we've got to, and sometimes the body just, it's just had enough, hasn't it? It's just, then we go and pick something up, and with the tiredness and with all those, these other constitutional things. So getting people to understand that acute and just paying respect to that is really important. And I will always say to people, look, there's no, again, there's no judgment for me. If you want to take some painkillers, or if you want to go and get some easy, quick fix at the beginning, that's fine. That's your choice to make. You, everybody has their own pain boundaries. I'm able to deal with when I have a bad acute, you know, musculoskeletal injury in my body. I know what I've done. I know what I've pushed to it, and I realize, oh, this is comeuppance for some of my stupidity. And then I recognize where what I've lost in my body, or I haven't been walking, I haven't been stretching, I haven't been moving, I've done too much lifting and too much driving, I've been stuck into too many patients, blah, blah, blah. But it just is a respect. You just got to understand, okay, that's my body throwing out a sign. The problem is that most people just don't link any of these signs, or have never had any linking of the signs to their body. It's all just, oh, I'm really sorry that you've got that, or I don't really understand why you've got it, or you must be unlucky that you've got it, here's some medication that will that will suppress it. And of course, if you are in raging pain, whether it's proper sciatic pain, or you have a, you know, you have some form of disc prolapse, or you've kind of got some compression, or you've torn some ligaments or something like that, then of course there is, you know, there's always morphine. At the end of the day, there's always some form of, like, you know, drug you up to the eyeballs, you won't feel anything, you'll be floating in the clouds. But up until that point, there's all versions of symptomatic relief. But if that just allows you to go back to the chair, or back to the wrong diet, or back to the thing that you were doing in before, then obviously you're going to be in a worse state than you were. If your body is physically collapsed, then, you know, what we put our bodies through, we would never do to a car or a building. Or if you did, you'd never drive that car or go in the building. We have these terrible, you know, fossils of these bodies coming in, which have very little understanding or relationship one bit to another. And yet we're driving around in them all day long.
And they're kind of maintenance free, aren't they? You know, for a lot of people, well, they think they are maintenance free. They never have to do anything with them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so everyone eating badly.
Yeah, it's badly, like, it's like at the moment, badly, isn't it? Like, and I like to think at the moment, you know, telling everybody about their little seasonal cough and cold that's happening at the moment as the seasons change, as it gets a lot darker. It is a lot darker. It's gone a little bit colder, but it's actually been very warm here in the UK. And that's you know, November, and people still walking around in shorts and t-shirts occasionally. It's just about to plummet. But the body can notice that change, and your skin constricts a little bit. We're wearing more clothes, so we're not sweating. And so when we're not sweating, that third kidney, i.e. our skin, isn't working anymore. And so the kidneys have to take over. And I liken this to just kind of in the wintertime, you go and you get into your old Rolls Royce in the garage that hasn't been driven for half a year, and you start the engine up, and bang, all this kind of black smoke comes flying out the back of this old engine as it literally clears the pipes. And so at the moment, everybody's reliance on the elimination going through their skin in this wonderful, lovely, hot summer that we've just had is now closing down. But the skin still is eliminating. It's still producing urea. It's still producing some of these toxic compounds. It's still giving off heat. But suddenly, as it goes cold and the central heating kicks in, the superficial circulation dies away, and our skin becomes a bit drier and maybe a bit itchier. And then so then we rely more on our kidneys and our lungs. But then, of course, we've got central heating going on. So the central heating dries the air, quite often we're really stressed. So most people are mouth breathers rather than nose breathers, which dries the back of their throat. And so, hey and behold, as the skin closes down, the lungs kick off and we have a cough and we have a cold and an irritable throat at the moment that everyone here in Stroud, everyone's got coughs and colds and little snotty noses and the kids all that, because it's this time of year where our bodies are changing. We're going from sunny and open and summery to dark and cold and wintry, and our body makes that physiological change. Now, if we can just see it, then you just have to put up with those days and put up with the fever and invite the fever into your home as far as your kids are concerned, because it's stopping that then throws said water on the bonfire outside. It's better to have 3 days of being acute and doing what the Chinese say, which is never stop snot on the brain. You know, allow your body to produce this toxic load and eliminate it through all of the orifices in your body, come out the other side a cleaner version of the person that you were before. And you know, going back to this original concept today of vitality, we're just thinking about people who are in a chronic state of disease where they don't have the vital energy to raise an acute eliminative effort, and you're there to say, okay, I have to really respect my mechanical and physiological principles that we have to understand, that sometimes we could just, we could lay them on a table and we could give them 4 hours of treatment, but we can't make them lose 10 stone and we can't change their diet and we can't take away the 6 months of deep adrenal cortisone stress that they might have placed on themselves. We can't do that. And so sometimes we have to back off and recognize when the patient's coming in with a list of drugs down their arm and a list of genie things that we spoke about at the beginning of what they want to achieve, that we just have to think, okay, well, actually, this person really needs a little bit of nurturing. And that probably I need to go a little bit more down that natural hygienic route of giving them more information and doing slightly less, because although they really want their money's worth of time on, I have to explain to them that, you know, me giving them a really long treatment might feel really nice today, but they might just not be able to cope with it the following day. And, you know, I leave that in with myself, that I had my own little treatment crisis at the end of summer, because, you know, my mum was moving home. So she sold the family house, went through about 3 months worth of going through my parents and my entire history, because it was the house where I was born. It was a little bit like I was clearing out a house from my mum that she died, but she was still alive. But the process was exhausting. It was adrenal. I was backwards and forwards with work. And I knew that there was about 3 weeks to go. And a friend came over and she gave me a treatment with some acupuncture. And my body just gripped hold of this treatment and just was like, yes, this is it. I'm going to do everything. And I was not ready for it. It's just set off this cataclysmic kind of treatment reaction, where my body just decided, right, that's it. I'm Humpty Dumpty. I'm going to break and I'm going to fall apart. I'm going to have a nice acute crisis in bed. But my body couldn't physically do that because I still had to move my mum out and I still had to do all these other things. So then you go through this patch of really seeing where somebody else has tried to help you and they've undone all these keys in your body. But actually, you really weren't ready for it. You know, I needed to do a load of work really before I had that treatment to get the most out of it. And the more reactive and the more responsive you are to treatment, and my body's very responsive to treatment, it's responsive to myself, but especially to other people. But the more reactive it is, the more it will grab hold of that power from the outside and it will use it. But if they haven't had any preparation, it can be really difficult to manage. And that is just a learning, that is a learning tool that we know about within yourself.
Practitionership, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And sometimes as well, if you do overdo it and you put people into that, you know, kind of force people into that kind of reaction when they're not ready, you don't get another bite of the cherry.
You don't unless they're prepared for it.
Yeah.
You know, and as I said, and then if you can prepare for it, but then that sort of stops it. And I'm amazed by the amount of osteopathic chat that will happen on some really rubbish Facebook groups about, like, you know, oh, I don't really understand. I, you know, treat this patient, they're in loads more pain, or I don't know what to do. I don't know what people are being taught out there nowadays, but it seems very abstract and very removed from some of these real necessities. I really think that the management of the acute and talking about this is your gateway, because it gives you this idea as to how to gently oscillate and articulate and integrate the patient back towards mechanical principles. It gives you a way to sort of delve into alkalinity and sunlight and all of these things that their bodies require. We've spoken about before on these sort of physiological principles. But then you're guiding them towards the acute crisis, but you're trying to make it as pleasant for them as possible. And exactly as you said, Diego, at the beginning, if or you said, Robert, if your dog's not coming down, if the dog knows what to do, you know, when they've injured themselves, the cat just disappears, don't they? They go find a bush, they crawl into it, they sleep, they don't eat, and they burn a fever. And they either come out of the bush or they don't.
Yeah.
You know, and
I think you know, a lot of the undergraduate stuff has become much more disease centric rather than, you know, looking for health. It's disease centric, screening for disease. And so often when you have these Facebook things, as you just said, and someone said, I don't know what's happening, has anyone else got any idea? And you'll get people punting in more and more obscure pathologies that it might be, you know.
And normally it's based, isn't it? It's based on actually what the worst case scenario is. Yeah. Have you made sure it's not this, you know, because we are still in a fear-based culture. And there are many times within the management of, let's say, childhood illnesses where they've got temperatures and coughs and this and certain rashes that come out. It's very hard to say exactly what's happening to them. But the one thing is for sure, the body knows what it's doing, and it's doing something right.
Yeah.
And as long as they're not in a sort of dangerous position, there are always ways that we can guide, not suppress, but support those conditions.
Support the process.
Support the process.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as you said at the beginning, Diego, like actually, you know, when people are acute, in acute physical pain, but also acute constitutional healing, it's not the time to be wading in with a really long treatment, and it's not the time to be talking to them lots. They need quiet. They need, as a lot of the nature cure and osteopathic books will talk about, they need to get the rest of the family out of the room. They need to have doubt removed from them. They just want to sleep. And it's everybody else who just wants them. Oh, if only they could eat and they could feel a bit better. You know, they might as well say, if only the person who's in there could make me feel better about myself, about them, it would make me feel much happier. Yeah. Like if they were in there and they were okay, if they weren't suffering so badly, I would be better out here. You know, can't they just suffer quietly? can't you suffer quietly? but it is true. You know, we quietness, calmness, you know, acute, you know, that's actually where I don't know the answers, but, you know, even I've had some conversations with the classical osteopaths deep within good physiological reflexes, which is, let's say you've got a child with a fever and the child comes in with a fever and you think, okay, I'm going to do some very gentle occipital inhibition because that will relieve some of the deep and the superficial circulation. And I'm going to inhibit through D1 to D4 because then that gives the superficial circulation. But I would say, like, well, why are you doing that in the first place? What's wrong with the child having a fever? Like, do we actually need to do anything about it? Like the child, the body inside of that child has decided to have a fever. Now, whether that's because of a bacterial infection or it's because of it's eaten some food that it shouldn't have, or it's the presence of something, or it needs some form of inflammation, but it's come in, whether it's chicken pox or measles or mumps or a tooth coming through or bad guts or like a healing, it doesn't really matter. The body's come in with a fever. Yeah. So who are we to even think, okay, well, the fever, the pamphlet on the fever section says, you know, press on these buttons. Well, and there's a lot of pressing on those buttons that can reduce the fever, but is that any good to the patient?
Well, sometimes it's to support the process, but to ameliorate suffering.
Ah, but who's the suffering in, Robert?
Well, sometimes it's pain for the child, you know, like a headache.
True. But sometimes it's the pain for the adult who's dealing with the child who's in the pain.
Yeah, and that's because, the fear.
Because my children have been in extreme amounts of pain But they have no reference point to the fact that I can do something to take the pain away, or I can give them something to take the pain away. Yeah. So whether that's a horse ripping out Skylar's toenail, or Zena being bit straight through the hand by a Great Dane dog, or falling on their face and half breaking their zygomatic, they don't have any. There's no like, just give me the pills or the Calpol or take me to the doctor. Mm. You know, the best they've got is, can you give me a cold flannel? Can you, they want mummy all the time, but when the kids are injured, it's where's daddy, you know?
When I say ameliorate suffering while supporting the process, I don't mean give them Calpol. I mean, a little bit of suboccipital inhibition to so they can comfortably sleep and go through that fever process.
Exactly. Mm. But then the funny thing is again, the hard difficulty with me is, it's still hard to know when you've suppressed it that helps them and when you've suppressed it when you don't. Like at a moment of transition of a female about to give birth to a baby, it will be the most heightened, won't it? You know, and you know, the midwife will look at you, and when the mother says, I can't do this anymore, that's it. I just don't think I've got enough. I can't do this anymore. And the midwife kind of goes, it's just happening right now. It's transition. This is it. Yeah. Okay. And so within that, that's at the point where we go, can I do something to alleviate their pain? What do I press on to make this better for them? But it's coming to a volcanic eruption where the body is doing something physiologically. And so within fevers, the body was trying to put a fever. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just being really dogmatic in the sense of, these are all the questions that have always gone through my head. When to do it, when not to do it, when shall we do it? You know, let alone cure, never touch a patient. Don't go in there as osteopaths and chiropractors do. Let the natural law and gravity is a lot more construct in what it wants to do. It doesn't mess around with all of our like things of what suffering is or what isn't and those kind of things. And I've only learned that in our last podcast by seeing the kids and seeing them at this age, where their real understanding is different because they just, their understanding or what they interpret pain, because me and Jasmine, there's no fear about the pain. We don't show any fear about the pain. We show them just total understanding and that we're sorry that they're suffering, but the suffering will do them the good. And so they have gone through that so many times that they just know they will feel horrible, but they will wake up and they will feel better. And even Zena or even Skylar will say, didn't Skylar's hair all like fall out and she had measles afterwards? It got really thin, didn't it? And then that huge lion's mane hair came out of it, like all of these developmental things that they remember as kids that were sometimes the biggest times where they were the most ill was the time when they got the most healthier, or the biggest changes happened afterwards. Their nails, their hair, their vibrancy, their immune system, their ability to deal with outside was the best after they had lost all of the weight and had 2 weeks of being really, really ill, for example.
I do agree with that. And it's knowing when to do something. And that is a really difficult thing. And you do have to ask yourself, who are you doing it for? Are you doing it for you? Yes. Or are you doing it for them?
Yes, absolutely. And it's very difficult within the process. I'm very lucky. Me and Jasmine went to school. We went to university together. We've gone through all of this together. I know a lot of osteopaths or people who have got these ideas, but they're with mainstream other halves. It's a very difficult, very different scenario.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice for us to be able to, you know, we support each other as far as parents are concerned. But I think that it probably in the teaching mechanism, what we're trying to do here, isn't it, is we're sharing these kind of stories as to these are a multi-faceted, multi-directional information that's coming into us palpatory, visually, olfactorily, like we are
emotionally.
We become so in contact with the patient. You know, lines are blurred as to how much we really understand a patient. I got laughed at the other day because I was running the men's group that I have here on a Friday, the outdoor lifestyle and men's group. And I came out afterwards and I said, oh, guys, someone left their jumper here the other day. Whose jumper is this? And the six or seven guys that were there, they said, oh, no, that's not us. And I said, oh, that's weird. And before I knew it, I picked up the clothes and I'd given them a good smell. And they were, what the hell are you doing? I think I know who this is. I don't know.
I might recognize them. Yeah.
I know the smell of this person. I know this microbiome.
Yeah.
You become so you become so entrenched in people's, stuff.
Yeah. You are the main part of their environment at that point. You are their environment.
Yeah. Yeah, you're the person pushing them on the swing.
Yeah, yeah.
You're the person rocking them on up and down on the seesaw. Mm. You know, you're becoming the external monitorer for their vibratory level. Mm. So as Diego's saying, they need to be shaken up a little bit. Yeah. And all these terms of holding on to something and you're rocking them. And it's not rocking. I'm going to hold it. I'm going to tap it. Sometimes you scratch a patient, scratch it. Rock and hit the patient. You give it a tummy, a rock and a pull and a pull, and then maybe go back to quiet again. How am I going to wake this organism up, or how am I going to dissipate force? How am I going to allow nervous, blood? How am I going to help heat to dissipate? These are all techniques, but. Monitoring of the patient, looking at them, how they are on your plinth, how they move, how they breathe, all of the things that they tell you and how they then respond to you under touch is I think just all the big clear indicators. And then you've got to see those patients who are much more on the acute, the chronic side, that are probably going to take quite a long time to push towards in the acute, where you've got other people who are coming in through the door and they are just on the acute phase already. And all of these techniques that we have to change physiology is the wonder, really.
It is. And it's such a wonderful thing to have and be involved in.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I was thinking, as you were talking, this quote from Steele saying that to find health should be the aim of the doctor, and anyone can find disease. And every aspect that you mentioned, even this funny thing about smelling, we need to find health. And if someone smells bad, there is a disease. There is something going on. There is not something wrong in the body, or the patient doesn't sleep, or how they move on the table. We're trying to find health. And of course, we are not doctors. We don't have to name diseases, but we know something is wrong in the body. And we are trying to push up the immune system, to move things around, work with the nervous system. But even doctors nowadays, the cancer therapy, they are trying to push new cells to develop and to fight against these cancer cells. So they are trying to find health within those cells. So we are trying to find health with the tools that we have, which is, treatment, healthy living, naturopathy. So I think everything you were saying, it was coming to my head to say this, but it is clear to my head.
Yeah, and I think I think that there was another quote. I don't know who it was from, either Little John or someone else, but the whole physiological thing of it was something along the lines of the greatest physician can help treat a patient when they're not even in the presence of them. You can give them advice from afar, and I think that that's important because that also empowers the patient. It's not that they have to just have their osteopath or they have to have that. I mean we're teaching them we're teaching them some of the rules that we're picking up of their body, and sometimes we're there to understand that maybe having asthma, for example, might actually seem easier to somebody and much nicer than having eczema. Now on the biological mechanism, the body would prefer to eliminate toxic waste through the skin than it would through the lungs. But the skin comes with all of its social and kind of external showings to our friends. You know, we don't like being covered in spots or eczemas or dry psoriasis or those kind of things. Whereas we can have perfectly shiny looking skin on the outside and have those, you know, psoriatic patches on our lungs, and we could have really bad, asthma, but we wouldn't see it from the outside. Then we've got this problem of how do we help the person express itself, and what do we understand it? It reminds me of a very old classical osteopath that said that they were treating someone with rheumatoid arthritis, and all of the hands were all gnarled up, and these, you know, really fused joints, and the person had come in, and so they were giving them, you know, the body adjustment, and they were working with them physically, but they were also kind of doing basic hydrotherapy and changing their diet and their lifestyle and stuff like this. And their skin and their joints and everything started to move a little bit easier, but their skin started sweating and they stank. And I can still remember being a student and the person saying, so I told the patient that they'd gone from having a life-threatening condition to being socially unacceptable.
I know exactly who you're talking about.
You know who I'm talking about. And it was brilliant because it was such a good response. It was saying, you know, like, their joints can work and their body's not necessarily attacking itself. But they absolutely stink because their sweat glands are kicking off, and they're breathing out some of this toxins. That made such a big impact on me all those years ago, because you're going, okay, fine, there are these different avenues, the skin, the lungs, the guts, the kidneys, and there is this overriding constitutional thing of fever and lethargy and loss of appetite. And on top of that, we've got this sort of mechanical approach, and mechanically wise, and through the viscerosomato and somatovisceral reflexes, we have such an amazing ability to kind of go straight into the matrix, into the mainframe of another patient, because of this ability to touch their skin and to breathe with them and to move with them and to, with treatment, to become part of their body. And so all of these textures and emotions and things that they can feel and we can feel within them are all part of changing and listening to their body. And the organism responds to that. But we would be silly if we thought that we could just take people who are in chronic states and not allow some of that pressure to come out. Like, you've got a very fizzy water bottle and you've got to take the top off. It's just how quickly could you undo the top without froth going everywhere?
One of the other things that person said was, if it looks like poo and smells like poo, it probably is poo. Talking about stuff that you're eliminating, you know, which is bodily waste, you know.
So you have to just be quite normal with the smells and the smells and the feelings and the vibrations that come off patients. But I would say again, you know, back to grow on, we look after ourselves as best as we can. We're in a better position to not be affected by that. So people who have very toxic patients, don't be surprised if you feel toxic afterwards. If you have somebody who's in acute physical pain, remind yourself that the vibration within that organism is really high. You know, and so they are vibrating with energy within their system. They're hot. They're... And that's like a bus coming up, pulling up next to your car, and it's got certain type of vibration, and then your car starts to shake as well, which is why if you take someone who's really acutely ill and you stick them in a room with 10 people, you might get 3 people, you might get 9 people who all get acute, and maybe those people have been in a closed off room, they've been next door, they haven't been in any physical contact, so it's not like the germs jump down their throat or something.
No.
Their body is responding to the vibration, and we can feel that, can't we? We know when our friends come in and they're upset. We know when your kids or your parents are angry or upset or let down. You could put terms and emotions and words to people's postures, and all of that is all emanating through vibration, not only through physicality but through toxicity. And so it's important that we have our own vibration as osteopaths, and we try and ground ourselves as best as we can, whether that's you know, barefoot treating and eating carefully and going outside and getting in nature and touching a tree between patients or washing your hands and emotionally thinking to try and get rid of the energy of that person and then trying to come into contact with your own breath to kind of put your own defenses up, because there are a lot of sick and ill and acute people out there. And that can be really, that can really run us down. You know, you can pile energy into a patient, feel absolutely deflated and give them loads of energy. And just almost respectful of the amount that the interaction will affect you as a as a practitioner as well. And so coming out of it, and how many people have treated bad necks and then 2 hours later in the afternoon feel like they have the same neck that the patient had, you know, because you're because you become posturally and fascially and viscerally and energetically part of that patient.
Alex, it's wonderful listening to you, and
it is.
You speak a lot. No, honestly, it's great. Listen, shall we? We've been talking for almost 2 hours, and
we were supposed to do 40 minutes.
40 minutes. No. I'm very sorry to stop you here, but just to so people will hook to the next episode. One, would you be happy to talk about the after that chronic stage and that change in life when people realize that, of course, I have to do something in my life and change different habits. And I know you are very much into exercise, therapeutic exercise, healthy exercise, movement, baths, all these changes that we have to do. Shall we do that on the next
I'd love
podcast?
To.
Yeah?
I'd love to do that. Yeah, just take yourselves further. And I just say, you know, if people listen to this and they, you know, some of it highlights them, or they've got questions, or they'd like us to talk about different avenues, just to, you know, they've hopefully got your numbers, but hopefully maybe there's a comments bar, or they can ask questions about things that they'd like to talk about. They can always, you know, I've had some good responses just on WhatsApp and text messages from osteopaths and from patients around the world and here who have picked up, you know, some of these podcasts and then kind of really just said, look, these are the things that have really made a difference to them. And I've got colleagues as well who have listened to that and really thought, oh, these are the things that I've taken from this new one. And, you know, there's questions because, you know, all of this is all a work in progress, isn't it? We've got so many doors to open. So if anybody has little snippets of stuff that we've spoken about today they'd like to carry on with, and as I said, I'd like to be able to do some maybe open lectures with people in the future, or we kind of do some movement classes where we kind of get everybody actually moving very slightly. I mean, I don't like really necessarily the word exercise, I just prefer movement. You know, and I move a lot during treatment, so I cover, you know, if I'm doing a 5 hours worth of osteopathic treatment, I'm probably, you know, covering a good four of those 5 hours on my knees or moving around. I'm very little time actually sitting down, which then allows me to just, I'm covering 4 hours worth of yoga whilst I'm treating other patients. And that makes me responsive to the treatment that I'm giving. It gives me more information and tactility, but it also improves my physical ability, and I'm not just sat at a chair. So, you know, as we go further forwards, what I'd like to do is to be able to encourage these healthy lifestyle changes and things that improve us as osteopaths, and then only improve our energy for ourselves and our interaction with the patients, and then and then it goes full cycle, and then we're back into this whole like healthcare thing. So let's look at all the positive things next week or next time. And anyone who's got any questions, get hold of one of us and say, "Oi, talk about this," or just be quiet and stop talking.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for giving us the time again, Alex. It's always wonderful, really stimulating and interesting listening to you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Lovely to speak to you guys. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Ciao. Bye.